Brandon has had to give up his lands in Oxfordshire and Berkshire to pay his debts. And now he keeps small state down in the country. He closes his eyes. It is bliss to think of. Two dukes on the run from him. His neighbour, Chapuis, comes in.
I told my master in dispatches that the king has visited you. My master is amazed that the king would go to a private house, to one not even a lord, but I told him, you should see the work he gets out of Cromwell.
He should have such a servant, he says. But, Eustache, you are an old hypocrite, you know. You would dance on my grave.
My dear Thomas, you are always the only opponent.
Thomas Avery smuggles into him Luca Pacioli's book of chess puzzles. He has soon done all the puzzles, and drawn out some of his own on blank pages at the back. His letters are brought, and he reviews the latest round of disasters. They say that the tailor at Munster, the king of Jerusalem with 16 wives, has had a row with one of them and cut her head off in the marketplace. He re-emerges into the world. Knock him down and he will get up. Death has called to inspect him. She has measured him, breathed into his face, walked away again. He is a little leaner, his clothes tell him. For a while he feels light, no longer grounded in the world, each day buoyant with possibilities. The Boleyns congratulate him heartily on his return to health. And so they should, for without him, how would they be what they are now? Cranmer, when they meet, keeps leaning forward to pat his shoulder and squeeze his hand. While he has been recovering, the king has cropped his hair. He has done this to disguise his increasing baldness, though it doesn't, not at all. His loyal counsellors have done the same, and soon it becomes a mark of fellowship between them. "By God, sir," Master Risley says, "if I wasn't frightened of you before, I would be now." "But call me," he says. "You were frightened of me before." There is no change in Richard's aspect. Committed to the tilting ground, he keeps his hair cropped to fit under a helmet. The shorn Master Risley looks more intelligent, if that were possible, and Ralph more determined and alert. Richard Rich has lost the vestiges of the boy he was. Suffolk's huge face has acquired a strange innocence. Monseigneur looks deceptively ascetic. As for Norfolk, no one notices the change. "What sort of hair did he have before?" Ralph asks. Strips of iron grey fortify his scalp, as if laid out by a military engineer. The fashion spreads into the country. When Roland Lee next pitches into the Rolls House, he thinks a cannonball is coming at him. His son's eyes look large and calm, a still golden colour. "Your mother would have wept over your baby curls," he says, rubbing his head affectionately. Gregory says, "Would she? I hardly remember her." As April goes out, four treacherous monks are put on trial. The oath has been offered them repeatedly, and refused. It is a year since the maid was put to death. The king showed mercy to her followers. He is not now so disposed. It is the Charterhouse of London where the mischief originates, that austere house of men who sleep on straw. It is where Thomas More tried his vocation, before it was revealed to him that the world needed his talents. He, Cromwell, has visited the house, as he has visited the recalcitrant community at Sion. He has spoken gently, he has spoken bluntly, he has threatened and cajoled. He has sent enlightened clerics to argue the king's case, and he has interviewed the disaffected members of the community and set them to work against their brethren. It is all to no avail. Their response is, go away and leave me to my sanctified death. If they think that they will maintain to the end the equanimity of their prayer lives, they are wrong, because the law demands the full traitor's penalty, the short spin in the wind, and the conscious public disembowelling, a brazier alight for human entrails. It is the most horrible of all deaths. Pain and rage and humiliation swallowed to the dregs. The fear so great that the strongest rebel is unmanned before the executioner with his knife can do the job. Before each one dies, he watches his fellows, and, cut down from the rope, he crawls like an animal round and round on the bloody boards. Wiltshire and George Boleyn are to represent the king at the spectacle, and Norfolk, who, grumbling, has been dragged up from the country and told to prepare for an embassy to France. Henry thinks of going himself to see the monks die, for the court will wear masks, edging on their high-stepping horses among the city officials and the ragged populace, who turn out by the hundreds to see any such show. But the king's build makes it difficult to disguise him, and he fears there may be demonstrations in favour of Catherine, still a favourite with the more verminous portion of every crowd. Young Richmond shall stand in for me, his father decides. One day he may have to defend in battle his half-sister's title, so it becomes him to learn the sights and sounds of slaughter. The boy comes to him at night, as the deaths are scheduled next day.
Good Master Secretary, take my place.
Will you take mine at my morning meeting with the king? Think of it like this, he says, firm and pleasant. If you plead sickness, or fall off your horse tomorrow, or vomit in front of your father-in-law, he'll never let you forget it. If you want him to let you into your bride's bed, prove yourself a man. Keep your eyes on the Duke, and pattern your conduct on his. But Norfolk himself comes to him when it's over, and says, Cromwell, I swear upon my life that one of the monks spoke when his heart was out. Jesus, he called. Jesus save us, poor Englishman. No, my lord, it is not possible he should do so.
Do you know that for a fact?
I know it from experience. The Duke quails. Let him think it, that his past deeds have included the pulling out of hearts.
I dare say you're right.
Norfolk crosses himself.
Must have been a voice from the crowd.
The night before the monks met their end, he had signed a pass for Margaret Roper the first in months. Surely, he thinks, for Meg to be with her father when traitors have been led out to their deaths, surely she will turn from her resolve. She will say to her father, Come now, the king is in his killing vein. You must take the oath as I have done. Make a mental reservation. Cross your fingers behind your back. Only ask for Cromwell or any officer of the king. Say the words, come home. But his tactic fails. She and her father stood dry-eyed at a window as the traitors were brought out, still in their habits, and launched on their journey to Tyburn. I always forget, he thinks, how more neither pities himself nor takes pity on others. Because I would have protected my own girls from such a sight, I think he would too. But he uses Meg to harden his resolve. If she will not give way, he cannot, and she will not give way. The following day he goes in to see Moore himself. The rain splashes and hisses from the stones underfoot. Walls and water are indistinguishable, and around small corners a wind moans like a winter wind. When he has struggled out of his wet outer layers, he stands chatting to the turnkey, Martin, getting the news of his wife and new baby. How shall I find him? He asks at last. And Martin says, Have you ever noticed how he has one shoulder up and the other down? It comes from overmuch writing, he says. One elbow on the desk, the other shoulder dropped. Well, whatever, Martin says. He looks like a little carved hunchback on a bench end. Moore has grown his beard. He looks as one imagines the prophets of Munster to look, though he would abhor the comparison.
Master Secretary, how does the king take the news from abroad? They say the Emperor's troops are on the move.
Yes, but to Tunis, I think. He casts a glance at the rain. If you were the Emperor, wouldn't you pick Tunis, rather than London? Look, I haven't come to quarrel with you. Just to see if you are comfortable. Moore says,
I hear you have sworn my fool Henry Pattinson.
He laughs. Whereas the men who died yesterday had followed your example and refused to swear.
Let me be clear. I am no example. I'm just myself alone. I say nothing against the act. I say nothing against the men that made it. I say nothing against the oath or against any man that swears it. Ah, yes. He sits down on the chest where Moore keeps his possessions. But all this saying nothing, it won't do for a jury, you know. Should it come to a jury? You have come to threaten me. The Emperor's feats of arms shorten the King's temper. He means to send you a commission who will want a straight answer as to his title. Oh, I'm sure your friends will be too good for me. Lord Audley, Richard Rich. Listen, ever since I came here, I have been preparing for my death at your hands, yes, yours, or at the hands of nature. All I require is peace and silence for my prayers.
Do you want to be a martyr?
No. What I want is to go home. I am weak, Thomas. I am weak, as we all are. I want the king to take me as his servant, his loving subject, as I have never ceased to be. I have never understood where the line is drawn between sacrifice and self-slaughter. Christ drew it. You don't see anything wrong with the comparison? Silence. The loud, contentious quality of Moore's silence, it's bouncing off the walls. Moore says he loves England, and he fears all England will be damned. He is offering some kind of bargain to his God who loves slaughter. It is expedient that one man shall die for the people. Well, I tell you, he says to himself, bargain all you like. Consign yourself to the hangman if you must. The people don't give a fourpenny fuck. Today is the 5th of May. In 2 days' time, the commission will visit you. We will ask you to sit. You will decline. You will stand before us looking like a desert father, and we snugly wrapped against the summer chill. I will say what I say. You will say what you say. And maybe I will concede you have won. I will walk away and leave you. The king is good subject if you say so, till your beard grows down to your knees and the spiders weave webs across your eyes. Well, that's his plan. Events overtake it. He says to Richard, has any damnable bishop of Rome in the history of his pox-ridden jurisdiction ever done anything so stupidly ill-timed as this? Farnese has announced England is to have a new cardinal, Bishop Fisher. Henry is enraged. He swears he will send Fisher's head across the sea to meet his hat. The 3rd of June, himself to the Tower, with Wiltshire for the Boleyn interest, and Charles Brandon, looking as if he would soon be fishing. Rich to make notes, Audley to make jokes. It's wet again, and Brandon says, this must be the worst summer ever, eh? Yes, he says. Good thing His Majesty isn't superstitious. They laugh. Suffolk, a little uncertainly. Some said the world would end in 1533. Last year had its adherents too. Why not this year? There is always somebody ready to claim that these are the end times, and nominate his neighbour as the Antichrist. The news from Munster is that the skies are falling fast. The besiegers are demanding unconditional surrender. The besieged are threatening mass suicide. He leads the way. Christ, what a place, Brandon says. Drips are spoiling his hat. Doesn't it oppress you? Oh, we're always here, Rich shrugs. One thing or another. Master Secretary is wanted at the Mint or the Jewel House. Martin lets them in. Moore's head jerks up as they enter. It's yes or no today, he says. Not even good day and how do you? Somebody has given Moore a comb for his beard. Well, what do I hear from Antwerp? Do I hear Tyndale is taken? That is not to the point, the Lord Chancellor says. Answer to the oath. Answer to the statute. Is it a lawfully made statute? They say he strayed outside and the Emperor's soldiers have seized him. he says coldly. Had you prior knowledge? Tyndale has been not just taken, but betrayed. Someone tempted him out of his haven, and Moore knows who. He sees himself, a second self, enacting another rainy morning just like this, in which he crosses the room, hauls the prisoner to his feet, beats out of him the name of his agent. Now, Your Grace, he says to Suffolk, you are wearing a violent expression. Pray be calm. Me, Brandon says. Audley laughs. Moore says, Tyndale's devil will desert him now. The Emperor will burn him, and the King will not lift a finger to save him, because Tyndale would not support his new marriage. Perhaps you think he showed sense there, Rich says. You must speak, Audley says, gently enough. Moore is agitated, words tumbling over each other. He is ignoring Audley, speaking to him, Cromwell. You cannot compel me to put myself in hazard. For if I had an opinion against your act of supremacy, which I do not concede, then your oath would be a two-edged sword. I must put my body in peril if I say no to it, my soul if I say yes to it. Therefore I say nothing. When you interrogated men you called heretics, you did not allow evasion. You compelled them to speak and racked if they would not. If they were made to answer, why not you? The cases are not the same. When I compel an answer from a heretic, I have the whole body of law behind me, the whole might of Christendom. What I am threatened with here is one particular law, one singular dispensation of recent make, recognized here but in no other country. He sees Rich make a note. He turns away. The end is the same. Fire for them, axe for you. If the King grants you that mercy, Brandon says. Moore quails. He curls up his fingers on the tabletop. He notices this, detached. So that's a way in. Put him in fear of the more lingering death. Even as he thinks it, he knows he will not do it. The notion is contaminating. On numbers, I suppose you have me beat. But have you looked at a map lately? Christendom is not what it was. Rich says, Master Secretary, Fisher is more a man than this prisoner before us, for Fisher dissents and takes the consequences. Sir Thomas, I think you would be an overt traitor if you dared. Moore says softly, Not so. It is not for me to thrust myself on God. It is for God to draw me to him. We take note of your obstinacy, Audley says. We spare you the methods you have used on others. He stands up. It is the King's pleasure that we move to indictment and trial. In the name of God, what ill can I effect from this place? I do nobody harm. I say none harm. I think none harm. If this be not enough to keep a man alive. He cuts in on him, incredulous. You do nobody harm. What about Baynham? You remember Baynham. You forfeited his goods, committed his poor wife to prison, saw him racked with your own eyes. You locked him in Bishop Stokesley's cellar. You had him back at your own house 2 days, chained upright to a post. You sent him again to Stokesley, saw him beaten and abused for a week, and still your spite was not exhausted. You sent him back to the Tower, and had him racked again, so that finally his body was so broken that they had to carry him in a chair when they took him to Smithfield to be burned alive. And you say, Thomas Moore, that you do no harm. Rich begins to gather Moore's papers from the table. It is suspected he has been passing letters to Fisher upstairs, which is not a bad thing, if collusion in Fisher's treason can be shown. Moore drops his hand on them, fingers spread, then shrugs, and yields them. Have them if you must. You read all I write. He says, Unless we hear soon of a change of heart, we must take away your pen and papers, and your books. I will send someone. Moore seems to shrink. He bites his lip. If you must take them now.
For shame, Suffolk says. Do you take us for porters, Master Moore?
Anne says, It is all about me. He bows. When finally you have out of Moore what troubles his singular conscience, you will find that what is at the root of it is that he will not bend his knee to my queenship.
She is small and white and angry, long fingers tip to tip, bending each other back, eyes bright. Before they go further, he has to recall to Henry last year's disaster, remind him that he cannot always have his own way just by asking for it. Last summer, Lord Dacre, who is one of the northern lords, was indicted for treason, accused of collusion with the Scots. Behind the accusation were the Clifford family, Dacre's hereditary enemies and rivals. Behind them, the Boleyns, for Dacre had been outspoken in support of the former queen. The stage was set in Westminster Hall, Norfolk presiding over the court, as high steward of the kingdom, and Dacre to be judged, as was his right, by 20 fellow lords. And then mistakes were made. Possibly the whole thing was a miscalculation, an affair driven too fast and hard by the Boleyns. Possibly he had erred in not taking charge of the prosecution himself. He had thought it was best to stay in the background, as many titled men have a spite against him for being who he is, and will take a risk to work him displeasure. Or else Norfolk was the problem, losing control of the court. Whatever the reason, the charges were thrown out, to an outpouring by the king of astonishment and rage. Dacre was taken straight back to the Tower, by the king's guard, and he was sent in to strike some deal which must, he knew, end with Dacre broken. At his trial, Dacre had talked for 7 hours in his own defence, but he, Cromwell, can talk for a week. Dacre had admitted to misprision of treason, a lesser offence. He bought a royal pardon for £10,000. He was released to go north again, a pauper. But the Queen was sick with frustration. She wanted an example made. And affairs in France are not going her way. Some say that at the mention of her name, Francois sniggers. She suspects, and she is right, that her man Cromwell is more interested in the friendship of the German princes than in an alliance with France. But she has to pick her time for that quarrel. And she says she will have no peace till Fisher is dead, till Moore is dead. So now she circles the room, agitated, less than regal, and she keeps veering towards Henry, touching his sleeve, touching his hand, and he brushes her away, each time as if she were a fly. He, Cromwell, watches. They are not the same couple from day to day, sometimes doting, sometimes chilly and distanced. The billing and cooing, on the whole, is the more painful to watch. "Fisher gives me no anxiety," he says. "His offence is clear. In Moore's case, morally our cause is unimpeachable. No one is in doubt of his loyalty to Rome and his hatred of your Majesty's title as head of the Church. Legally, however, our case is slender, and Moore will use every legal, every procedural device open to him. This is not going to be easy." Henry stirs into life. "Do I retain you for what is easy? Jesus pity my simplicity. I have promoted you to a place in this kingdom that no one, no one of your breeding, has ever held in the whole of the history of this realm." He drops his voice. "Do you think it is for your personal beauty, the charm of your presence? I keep you, Master Cromwell, because you are as cunning as a bag of serpents. But do not be a viper in my bosom. You know my decision. Executed." As he leaves, he is conscious of the silence falling behind him, Anne walking to the window, Henry staring at his feet. So when Rich comes in, quivering with undisclosed secrets, he is inclined to swat him like a fly. But then he takes hold of himself, rubs his palms together instead. The merriest man in London. Well, Sir Purse, did you pack up the books? And how was he?
He drew the blind down. I asked him why, and he said, "The goods are taken away, so now I am closing the shop."
He can hardly bear it, to think of Moore sitting in the dark.
"Look, sir." Rich has a folded paper. "We had some conversation. I wrote it down."
"Talk me through it." He sits down. "I am Moore, you are Rich."
Rich stares at him. "Shall I close the shutter? Is this better played out in the dark?"
"I could not," Rich says, hesitant, "leave him without trying once again."
"Quite. You have your way to make. But why would he talk to you if he would not talk to me?"
"Because he has no time for me. He thinks I don't matter."
"And you, Solicitor General," he says, mocking.
"So we were putting cases."
"What, as if you were at Lincoln's Inn after supper?"
"To tell the truth, I pitied him, sir. He craves conversation, and you know he rattles away. I said to him, suppose Parliament were to pass an act saying that I, Richard Rich, were to be king. Would you not take me for king?" And he laughed.
"Well, you admit it is not likely."
"So I pressed him on it. He said, yes, majestic Richard, I so take you, for Parliament can do it, and considering what they have done already, I should hardly be surprised if I woke up in the reign of King Cromwell. For if a traitor can be king of Jerusalem, I suppose a lad from the smithy can be king of England."
Rich pauses. Has he given offence? He beams at him. "When I am King Cromwell, you shall be a duke. So, to the point, Purse. Or isn't there one?"
Moore said, "Well, you have put a case. I shall put you a higher case. Suppose Parliament were to pass an act saying God should not be God." I said it would have no effect, for Parliament has no power to do it. Then he said, "Aye, well, young man, at least you recognise an absurdity." And there he stopped, and gave me a look, as if to say, "Let us deal in the real world now." I said to him, "I will put you a middle case. You know our Lord the King has been named by Parliament head of the Church. Why will you not go with the vote, as you go with it when it makes me monarch?" And he said, as if he were instructing some child, "The cases are not alike. For one is a temporal jurisdiction, and Parliament can do it. The other is a spiritual jurisdiction, and is what Parliament cannot exercise, for the jurisdiction is out of this realm." He stares at Rich.
"Hang him for a papist."
"Yes, sir."
"We know he thinks it. He has never stated it."
"He said that a higher law governed this and all realms. And if Parliament trespassed on God's law..."
"On the Pope's law, he means. For he holds them the same. He couldn't deny that, could he? Why is he always examining his conscience, if not to check day and night that it is in accord with the Church of Rome? That is his comfort, that is his guide. It seems to me, if he plainly denies Parliament its capacity, he denies the King his title, which is treason. Still," he shrugs, "how far does it take us? Can we show the denial was malicious? He will say, I suppose, that it was just talk to pass the time, that he were putting cases, and that anything said in that wise cannot be held against a man. A jury won't understand that. They'll take him to mean what he said. After all, sir, he knew it wasn't some student's debate." "True. You don't hold those at the Tower."
Rich offers the memorandum. "I have written it down faithfully to the best of my recollection."
"You don't have a witness?"
"They were in and out, packing up the books in a crate. He had a lot of books. You cannot blame me for carelessness, sir, for how was I to know he would talk to me at all?"
"I don't blame you." He sighs.
"In fact, Purse, you are the apple of my eye. You'll stand behind this in court?"
"Doubtful," Rich nods.
Tell me you will, Richard. Or tell me you won't. Let's have it straight.